Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening, everyone. This is Ken McKinn welcoming you once again to Nature's Talk Show and tonight's Monsters of Nature. Before we go into our show, though, Ken Borman and I would like to invite you to please go to naturestalkshow.com, www.naturestalkshow.com, and join in our live chat room where Ken Borman is right now. And, Ken, we've got a cool show. Supposedly one of the most feared creatures in the Amazon basin. Isn't that pretty wild?
It is. I'm looking forward to this show. It should be interesting.
Yeah, well, our monster that Ken and I chose for tonight is the Candiru catfish. So it's an interesting little parasitic catfish that lives in South America, and the natives have claimed that they fear it more than the piranha. Now, Ken, when you and I were young, I think we had piranhas on our show a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was a kid that piranhas were supposedly the most feared fish in South America. They were, you know, you'd go wade into water and your bones would be stripped in seconds.
That was the story going around, and we believed it.
We believed it, yeah, because I remember when I was first getting into aquarium fish back in the 1970 and thereabouts, that I actually acquired piranhas because I was fascinated by them. You know, I wanted to see those fish, you know, but they weren't the monster that they've been, you know, they were originally made out to be, and you find out that they're actually just a very important part of the Amazonian ecosystem. But we're going to talk about a fish tonight and some creatures tonight, and that I wonder where their place is in the ecosystem, you know, is there, because one of the things that we're talking about tonight is parasitism. And Ken, that of all the things in nature, I think being eaten by a parasite just really bothers me, knowing that worms would be crawling around in me or something like that, you know?
I can think of nothing worse, you know, to just imagine someone with a tapeworm in them. It's bad enough that they've got it in there, but to know you've got it in you.
Yeah,
that's awful.
And I've seen, you know, there's other creatures, you know, when you think about it. It's just, you know, just they're taking the easy way. They don't usually don't contribute anything back to their host, you know. They take and take and take. And now, when it comes to vertebrate parasites, you know, the Candiru catfish is actually fairly recent on the scene when it comes to parasitic fishes. And one mm-hmm. of the oldest lineages of parasitic fishes that I can think of are the lampreys.
Yes, I've been around for a long, long time, haven't I?
Well, they're have their origins with the jawless fishes back in the Precambrian, actually, to the earliest Cambrian.
Wow, they're a very, very successful group.
Well, they were the different jawless fishes. The ones that we find mostly in the fossil record that are related to lamprey. Now, an interesting thing about them I find fascinating, Ken, is they all had bone. Usually they had bony shields, and other parts were protected and covered by bone. Some of them had scales. Some of them had smaller scales. Some of them had bony plates. You know, I think one of the interesting, most interesting fishes today that I can think that resembles how probably one of these armored ostracoderms were is the armored catfishes of South America. When you look at one of those, except for being a modern, you know, fairly modern fish, I think you're almost looking at what some of the ostracoderms could look like. You know, the bony covering on them, and
some of them certainly have that appearance, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's when I was a kid. That's one of the first things that attracted me to that group of fishes when I first got into aquariums, you know, was you know, they had this prehistoric look about them.
Yeah, and then, of course, that's just another case of convergence, isn't it?
I'm wondering if that isn't kind of a case, you know, when we're looking at that, because when we look through the fossil record, that's one thing we see in certain habitats. We see a lot of convergence of other animals from other groups. You know, if something has the ability to evolve into that niche, it'll evolve into that niche. Not every organism is adaptable to that. There's some, you know, some things just are not reachable. It'd be like when we talked about the transgression of animals onto land. We talked about why a mudskipper will not turn into a terrestrial animal like we, because it lacks several critical factors, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So. But how did lampreys, you know, evolve parasitism? You know, what was the motivation, you know, back in when these first evolved? Because I think the earliest or the oldest fossil lampreys that we've been able to find, from what I understand, Ken, date back to like the Carboniferous period.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah. But there's a lot of lineage there between the Cambrian, its Cambrian ancestors to where it is, because it the lineage has been traced. I think when we look at their evolution, I think the Cephalaspidomorph. That's a mouthful.
I'm glad you said that. I couldn't even attempt that one.
Okay, yeah, Cephalaspidomorphi. Okay. That seems to be probably the animals that they're the sole surviving representatives of. And so... even when we look back at some of the fossil ones, now we do see where they probably could have been parasitic.
Well, I guess it's a niche. Sucking the blood or eating the flesh of another animal is actually quite common, I guess, so. If you can just go on and grab a couple of mouthfuls and then detach, well, there you go. It's even better, and your prey is still living.
You see that, you know, there's a lot of groups when you think about it, does that. Cichlids, you know, you got the scale eaters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These fish, like you said, they come up and grab a mouthful of scales, and when you got a group, you know, the lakes that they live in are full of fish, you know, it's easy just to run around grabbing mouthfuls and mouthfuls, you know. And, I actually one of my favorite those fishes, and is the African eye biter, and these are known to go around and grab the eyes out of other fish. Now that's a pretty nasty form of is that a parasitism? Would you think, or how would you describe that behavior? You know,
It's hard, isn't it? You don't know whether it's just being a carnivore and being a specialized carnivore, or being a parasite. Where do you draw the line?
When we look at the lampreys, one of the interesting things now, there's approximately 38 to 40 species of lampreys, and only about this little under half of them are parasitic. So only the other half have lost that ability. I think because they do share the buccal cavities. That's what we're seeing. We're seeing them degenerate. You know, they get all their nourishment while they're still a larva. Then mm-hmm. they transform into just the male and females that breed and then die.
Wow.
So, but now the ones that I've dealt with, I've actually worked here in the United States with two types of lampreys. One was the least brook lamprey, which is a non-parasitic type, and mm-hmm. the other one that I've had in the past is called the chestnut lamprey, and it comes from the waters of Missouri. Actually, both lamprey species I had, one came from they both came from the eastern side of Missouri. But the chestnut lamprey was a full-on parasite, and I remember I donated to the New Mexico Museum of Natural History for their biology room, Ken, and they actually bought a large goldfish, and they would put the goldfish in with it every week or so. The lamprey would attach itself to the goldfish and then feed for a couple hours and then detach itself, and they would remove the goldfish, and the lamprey lived for quite a while for the museum. Yeah, but they fed it goldfish, so to speak.
Well, I guess any fish will do in the storm.
Well, in the Mississippi River, where I guess you could say where the adults would migrate to, as they would. And also the Merrimack River, the Missouri River, the Wabash, the White Rivers. These all actually have large minnows that live in them called. Let me see if I can pull it out of my head here. The buffaloes, and also the carp suckers. But the buffaloes resemble a carp when you look at them.
Mm-hmm.
The common carp, Asian carp or your European carp.
Right.
And there's the differences, of course, that besides when you look at them, is the Asian carp has a few other minor differences. But what you can say, it's convergence. Once again, we got the two fishes living in similar habitats, one in Asia, one in America, North America. But the lampreys would feed on these guys. That's what these fish were feeding on. They were feeding up on the paddlefishes, catfishes. There's several big species of catfish that inhabit the river systems like that. And that's what these parasitic lampreys would feed upon. And when we go back through the periods, we see the fish species that would have provided these animals with a base to feed upon.
Right. When I was living in Australia, Ken, Australia has its own lamprey, perhaps lamprey. It's only found in Australia and New Zealand. And it has an andromenous, I think is the word, lifestyle, where it matures and swims out and lives in the salt water, and that's where it parasitizes other fish. But then it swims upstream, like salmon, to breed in the fresh waters. And the larvae live up to 4 years before they metamorphize and swim out into the ocean again. But we heard about the lampreys in North America, and I only thought there was one type. That's, of course, the sea lamprey in the Great Lakes.
Yeah, actually, that's the one that's kind of the invasive species, because there's Lampetra and Petromyzon, I believe, are two genera. Is it Petromyzon? I know we have Lampetra. Is that the only genus listed here? Sea lamprey, for the longest time, was just known in the lower part, I think, of the St. Lawrence River drainage.
Mm-hmm.
And then back in the 1800s, they built the Erie Canal. The sea lamprey to immigrate far up river and bypass the Niagara Falls.
Right.
So when that happened, it opened up the Great Lakes to the sea lamprey, and it was devastating, I guess, because the Niagara Falls kept the lampreys out of the Great Lakes,
Mm-hmm. It's pretty hard to swim up something like that, isn't it?
What's that?
It's pretty hard to swim up something like that.
Yeah, I've been to Niagara Falls and seen it, and it's a heck of a falls, that's for sure. And right now, it's interesting is because it only runs about half of its full force, because they siphon it off to run the generators,
mm-hmm.
power stations. So you can imagine before, the Erie Canal and all that was, how much volume of water was probably roaring over that thing. It kept a lot of stuff. you know, it was a big natural barrier for immigration of a lot of animals up into the Great Lakes systems. But these sea lampreys, once they got into the Great Lakes, they kind of went, well, they had just a virtually full stocks of fish. They devastated the trout, lake trout, and some of the other fishes that the Great Lakes were known for. Just totally devastated the fisheries and stuff of that, because they would just parasitize. They were so big. These things, I believe, get close to 3 feet to a meter long.
That's a huge parasite, isn't it?
Huge parasite. Oh, my gosh.
And they're not skinny either, really.
No. No,
they're a fish.
And when you've got there were so many that, you know, you see I remember seeing photographs showing, you know, three or four lampreys hanging off a single trout.
That would certainly be enough to kill a lot of animals, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and these things would they lay thousands of eggs, you know, hundreds of thousands of eggs, I think, or something like that. I mean, it's the number is phenomenal. How much they lay. And once again, the sea lamprey, where they spawn, they swim up into the freshwater streams that drain into the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
They build nests, and the males and females lay their eggs and kind of cover with the gravel. The eggs hatch out. The amacetes find a quiet spot in the stream channels where they settle down in the bottom muck. And they set up for several years feeding on the filter feeding. And when they, these guys, now I'm not sure how long these, how many times they can spawn. I've not really studied up on the sea lamprey. It's been a long time, Ken. I forgot so much about these things. I'm going to have you guys, listeners, out there, I'm going to admit it. I've forgotten a lot more than I know now. You know, when you see people talking about the old timer and said, yeah, he's forgotten more than you know.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that way sometimes. But but anyway, you know, when you've got this many parasites being released into the you know, closed system like the Great Lakes, you know, and they devastated. So they had a big old a war, I think, in the 60s. That they wage, and they still do it. They still go in and try to poison and keep these things out. But they've, I think they've developed species selective toxins now for these lampreys.
Well, that's something.
Yeah. And that way it doesn't affect too much of the ecosystem other than taking out the lampreys. So, but I find them fascinating fishes overall, Ken. I mean, I'm really amazed about these animals because they are such a link, you know, to the past, even though they have a disgusting way of living. If you're going to keep one of these parasitic ones, you know, in an aquarium, you have to be able to put up with, you know, its life form. Now, if you want to keep one of the non-parasitic forms, the best way to get one of those is as a young amacete and
mm-hmm.
raise them in the larval state, I guess.
And they do look like eels, don't they? Even though they're not.
Yeah, they've lost their armor. Basically, is what it is. They're a degenerative type of jawless fish, I guess, is what I'm trying
mm-hmm.
to say. Yeah, they're kind
right.
of degenerated because the earliest ancestors that they have, they had the type they the line they come from did have bony structures on them originally.
Yeah, they don't appear to me to have normal gills either. They're a weird setup, aren't they?
They've got a basket chamber. That is kind of different, but we can see when we look at some of the oldest of the jawless fishes that they almost all of them had some a similar type of basket type set up inside their skull.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a you know a lot more gills. In the lamprey compared to the conventional bony fishes that we know.
And these certainly an array of teeth.
What's that?
Certainly an array of teeth on their basal, on their sucking disc at the front of their head.
Yeah. Yeah, the pattern on it is very interesting. You know, they have the teeth around the buccal cavity are usually for helping grasp and hold on, because, you know, when you've got something getting ready to rasp a hole in your skin, you're not going to want to sit there and take it.
You want to try and shake that sucker off, don't you?
Yeah, and they've got a tongue that has these rasping teeth as well, and that's what they use to sit there and scrape through the skin of the fish and everything and get it to where it's bleeding, its fluids into the cavity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just a really disgusting type of, like I said, I don't like, I don't think anybody really likes parasites.
No.
But something that goes through my blood, it's like, yeah, there's a big price to pay to feed on Leroy here.
The affinity to kanduru is remarkable, actually, isn't it? It's, again, the kanduru sucks, is a blood eater.
Well, this is kind of, but kind of cool, except for the sea lamprey, Ken. Most of these guys don't get all that big, you know. But they do range from 5 to from 13 to 100 centimeters. But most of them are small. Like the chestnut lamprey that I've collected, it was only maybe 20 centimeters long. 10 centimeters.
Right. So
yeah, about 20 centimeters. Mm-hmm. You know?
8 inches for the people who don't know metric.
Yeah, just about that long, and they didn't, you know, they didn't get much bigger than that. Now a big kanduru is close to that, 6 to 8 inches in size, I guess.
Yeah, some species can get bigger.
Yeah, so here we are seeing a fish parasite that. But the lamprey, because it didn't have a jaw, you know, it managed to become a sucking animal.
Mm-hmm.
And now when we look at the kanduru, and I need to look up the kanduru, we have a catfish.
A highly evolved catfish, really, isn't it?
Yeah, you know. And I find its evolution actually very interesting, you know, how it evolved to be a parasite.
And, of course, normally it doesn't parasitize on humans. It normally preys on other fishes, again, and it attacks their gills, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It feeds on the gills and the blood stuff that comes out of them, you know. So now I'd heard that they were attracted to chemicals emitted by chemicals. But it seems, though, that they actually hunt by visual.
Yeah, yeah, I'd heard that, too. And I thought they were attracted to urea, actually, which would be produced by the fish's gills. And, of course, as the fish respire, the gills are pulsing, and urea is being passed out of the gills. And I just assumed, like a lot of other people, that the kanduru were attracted to it and then kind of swam up into the gills and attached themselves with their little barbels and that, and just started sucking blood.
Yeah, that's kind of
what it is. What happens, but for a different reason, as you just alluded to, it's a visual thing rather than a chemical trace, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I've seen a lot of photographs of from the Amazon. You know, and a lot of the water, you know, for the most part, back in these places, is pretty clear.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I guess it's a huge drainage, and you have turbid water, certainly, but there are quite a lot of black water and white water habitats that are remarkably clear.
Yeah. Hmm.
Well, that's the other thing, too. I guess these fish are found in the Amazon and the Orinoco rivers in South America.
I'm trying to see how many species that there are of these guys. But well, it looks like they belong the Trichomycetaridae. These guys, long, a little long, naked elongated catfish, have their barbels, of course. These don't have an adipose fin or pelvic, so that sets them off from a lot of other fish. They're, you know, easy to helps in their identification.
They do have barbels to suck all catfish, and and they certainly use them to anchor themselves.
I wonder. Interesting little creatures, you know. I wonder. Now, I believe there are some species that are not parasitic, aren't they?
Yes, I saw a special on them early last year, about a year ago, and apparently some of the, especially the big ones, are certainly not parasites. They're full-on carnivores, and what they'll do is act like an eel, and if an animal has fallen into the water, be it dead or alive, whatever, more likely dead, they'll actually swim into the beast however they can, either through the eyes, the mouth, nose, any other bodily opening that they can squirm their way into, and they'll start eating the creature from the inside. That sounds horrible, but that's what they have evolved to do, and that's why they've got that long eel-like body. It affords them egress into the body of, say, a mammal.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and they will eat it from the inside out, and the show that I watched, they put a beast in, like a cow. And you could see the whole body writhing from the inside. And it was all the big kangaroo catfish squirming around and eating it from the inside. It was a horrendous sight, but apparently that's what they do.
Well, that's a scavenger, of course, right there when they're doing that, helping clean up the river systems. That's pretty cool. But it is interesting, you know, that this family has quite a diverse way of feeding and keeping them, you know, themselves going. The parasites apparently are just mostly, I guess, restricted to the smaller species.
Yeah, normally we're just talking about Vindalia serosa, I guess.
Yeah.
When talking about kangaroo, that's the one that everyone thinks swims up your male parts or female parts and lodges. But apparently that's been, on the whole, discounted.
Is that
one proven case, and they don't know what happened there, but the story is certainly done the rounds, and it keeps getting retold and retold and retold so often that people think it's true. But in fact, there's only been one documented case in recent history where they have found a kangaroo inside a man's appendage, shall we say.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like something you'd see the American tourists coming into the Amazon, you know, and they're loud, making noise, you know, and the natives, you know, around are telling them these horror stories, you know, to shut them up.
Well, you can say that, Ken. You're American. I can't. I'm an Aussie.
Oh, yeah.
Canada.
I know the type.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these countries, they do, everywhere's got their, you know, tales of monsters and stuff, you know, and things. And I think that's, you know, what this is here. This is just a little animal that has actually been, you know, the tale has just been exaggerated to you know, they, maybe just scare the kids and frighten the visitors in those regions, do you think?
I think so, but we, well, scientists even were suckered into it too. They worked out that the fish swim upstream against the exhalation from the fish that they're going to parasitize, you know, through the gills. So they're swimming against the current, and they're attracted to the urea that is passed out through the fish's gills. So they worked out a system of feeding that, quite frankly, wasn't there.
You know, that does happen a lot in science. Matter of fact, to this day, Ken, I still say there's a group of scientists out there that have misread their data. And to this date, they're arguing something that's not there, and that, of course, there's a, you know, time difference between here on Earth and out in space. You know, they supposedly sent the molecular clocks, you know, had one here on Earth,
uh-huh,
sent one
right
to space, then brought the one back down, and there's a time change in the two. And they're saying, oh, that's proof that time slows down in space. And I'm saying, no, what you dummies are failing to recognize is that's not that. It's the effect of the gravity well upon the vibration of the atomic structure of the atoms in your atomic clock, and not a change in time, but a change in the vibration pattern, because gravity is affecting it different, not because it's time's moving faster or slower, because that is impossible.
That's right. So, yeah, there's a perfect example of that too. You extrapolate the wrong data from a known set of facts, and once you've got that into your head, it's very, very, very difficult to admit that you were wrong for a start.
Oh yeah. Well, what's funny is one of my friends that goes out in the field with us, he's a geologist, but he's also a physics teacher. And I argued that point with him, but he's of the old school. And he says, no, you don't know what you're talking about. That proves this. And I said, no, it doesn't prove nothing. You know, he goes, well, satellites, they work on this time thing. I said, yeah, because distance and time works out in the triangulation of that. That's not because time is slower or faster. That's just because it takes this much longer for it to get there. It's like walking to the store or running to the store, you know?
Right.
Oh, my gosh. It's like, come on, scientists. You don't have to overcomplicate it.
And that was, and that's certainly what happened with the kangaroo. They'd worked out this feeding schedule, and that explained why, if you went and urinated in the waters where the kangaroo was around, they'd swim against the current, and lodge themselves into a wee little dark crevice, for want of a better word, and start sucking the blood.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, it seems like what we have shown them that tonight, once again, this monster of nature is not quite the monster that it was made out to be.
No, not what it's made out to be. It is still somewhat of a monster. It does parasitize living fish, but
definitely a monster to
them. Only on fish. It's very rare, as we've tried to allude, that it attacks or comes anywhere near actually mammals.
Well, I think it's probably safe to say you can go in the water in the Amazon and not have to worry about having to be rushed to the hospital to have a kangaroo catfish removed from your body. But then again, maybe it is best to come up and go behind a tree.
Well, it's not a good idea to urinate anywhere.
Yeah.
So don't pee in the streams in the Amazon.
Yeah, anyway. The guy downstream's got to drink your water.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ken, I hate to say this, but we've covered the kangaroo catfish and parasites really good tonight.
We have, actually. They're an interesting group, and of course, you never see them imported. You never see them in the local fish store. But it's certainly one. If I had the opportunity, I think I'd like to try and keep some in an aquarium.
Yeah, I think it'd be fascinating, you know. And I think we're going to have an early show tonight, guys. We'll be able to kick back a little bit early tonight and take it easy, because tomorrow night, Ken, you and I are going to probably We've got a lot to talk about tomorrow night on the show.
Yes, it should be an interesting show. Of course, that's on Permian herbivorous ecosystems, isn't it? It's,
yes.
Different dinosaurs. Well, not dinosaurs. Some.
Yeah, the oldest ecosystems that we know were vertebrates were feeding herbivores. It was the first systems with Diadectes and Dapsosaurus. So we want to invite everybody to join us tomorrow night for that show. Now, we'll pick you guys out another good monster here, and we'll have Mary get it up for you folks to check it out. As Ken and I, we've got some other monsters here in nature that we want to bring to you. And you know what? I think something
that
might be fun to talk about in Monsters of Nature might be the bats. A lot of people are afraid of the bats.
Yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about another creature, the vampire bat.
Vampire and otherwise.
And, well, the vampire bats is known to have actually parasitized on humans.
Yep.
So,
and certainly cows.
So,
cattle. So, yeah, all right, we can talk about that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because there's a lot of people out there, and bats are given a lot of bad press, and we now know that they're a big part of the ecosystem. But they do have their moments.
Sure.
They can carry diseases, and as we mentioned, the vampire bat will attack humans in the South Central American countries. I think it lives in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
That particular species.
Central and
so,
South, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. That'll be fun.
Next Sunday, we've got a biotope show, don't we, Ken?
You and I have been able to go visit and live in, to me, one of the most incredible ecosystems, Ken, and that's deserts.
Deserts, they're an awesome place. And the animals and plants that have evolved to live there are just unique, aren't they?
There's amazing stuff that lives in this desert. I have found stuff that I would not believe live in the desert. Salamanders out here, Ken. There's frogs
mm-hmm.
and toads here in the New Mexico desert. Of course, grew up in Australia, so you've got
mm-hmm.
the deserts there you're familiar with, aren't you?
Sure. Yeah, I've been out to the deserts in Australia, and there are a lot of them. It's a very, very dry continent. It's huge, actually. So it'll be interesting to talk about them with you next week.
Yeah, well, I live here on the north end of the Chihuahua Desert, and I've been to the Sonora and the Mojave Deserts here in New Mexico and southwestern United States. So it'll be fun as we talk about that ecosystem, you know. So sounds like we've got some great stuff, and I know here coming up real soon on our next Tank Topics, we're going to be talking about the Corydoras catfishes as well, so people can tune in for that there. So... anything you'd like to add about Candiru's?
No, I think we've covered that pretty good. I'd just like to remind everyone that if you'd like to meet us, come along to the NEC, the Northeast Council Convention, on April 8th and 10th at Rocky Hill, Connecticut. If you're in the area, come along. It's going to be a great weekend. You can meet Tom, Mary, myself, quite possibly Ray, as Ozek is coming up too. And... come up and say good day. We'll talk with anyone. So come in and say hello. It's a great weekend. There's a lot of speakers lined up, 14 different programs. Of course, there's the all-day Sunday auction and on for all fishy things. There'll be a vendor and manufacturer hall, which is where we will be. There's a full floor devoted to room sales. So come along and grab the fish. It'll
and
be interesting.
And the people there are, at the NEC conference are wonderful, wonderful people. I was there a guest speaker a couple years ago, and the Friday night guest speaker. That was a blast being talking about my favorite subject, the evolution of fish. And Ken, people come up to the KOAC show in May, they can see you and I together, along with Ron Bishop, I believe, the Tank Topics gang.
Yep.
And of course, the Fine Art of Paleontology, another show gang, you and I.
Yeah. So come along and all the Canadians come along and say hello, and we'll talk to you. Well, everyone knows I'll talk to anyone anyway.
Oh, they know that's me too. I'm the infernal talker, you know. So at least I try to have something interesting to say.
But come along, between us, between Ken and I, we've probably got 100 years of fish keeping experience between us. So
alone, just fish keeping.
Yeah.
Now.
So, you know, come along, ask questions,
mm-hmm.
make comments, whatever you want to.
Yeah, we're fun to hang out with, and you know, so come and sit down and kick back with us. And also, I'm going to be up in Denver Memorial Day weekend. For the American Killifish Association National Convention there. I'll be doing a guest speaker, a talk there, the evolution of killifishes too. So come up and visit with me up there and see artwork, and maybe you can win one of my paintings. Also, for our listeners out there, I'll be donating artwork to KWAC. And Ken, tomorrow I'm going to get your address from you so I can send the artwork off to you.
Done.
All right. What
Very
are we,
good. don't forget to... DonaldLantonNaturesTalkShow.com. As we said, always say, come along. If you've got any questions, ask in the chat room. But read all the interesting articles on there, and there are plenty there. Visit our swag store if you want to get some clothing. It will help us to present these shows for you all. There is a donate button there on that page. Help us out, and whatever we receive goes straight back into the show. None of us get paid here, and we just love presenting all this information to you.
Yeah, and it's one that's a matter of fact. Ken, you and I've been visiting with the listeners now for going on 3 years, and it's a blast. I look forward to these here when you and I can sit down and have our evening chats about all the amazing stuff around us.
Wow.
Yeah.
We must have done several hundred shows then.
We've done a bunch. So, with that then, Ken, thank you very kindly, and I'll see you tomorrow night, and our listeners as well. How's that sound?
Excellent. Very
All
good.
Right.
Thank you. As always, thank you, Ken.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Good night from me.